I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we are going to talk more about that very sad case out of New Jersey. A former Rutgers University student was convicted on Friday of a hate crime after he used a webcam to spy briefly on Tyler Clementi, his freshman roommate, while Clementi had an intimate encounter with another man. Days later, Clementi took his own life. We decided to hone in on some of the legal issues raised by this case and this verdict in a few minutes. But first, we want to talk more about the race for the White House. The contest moves to Illinois tomorrow after Mitt Romney scored a blowout win and more delegates on Sunday in Puerto Rico. In his victory speech, Romney argued that his Puerto Rico win proves that he can win over Latino voters in his bid to challenge President Obama in the fall.
See there that conservative principles and Latino voters go together, and that Hispanic voters are going to vote for Republicans if we stand for something, conservative principles that bring growth and good jobs and rising home values. That's why we're going to win. We're going to get Latino voters to help us out.
Romney's rival, former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, is campaigning hard for Illinois, too. That's not the only big-ticket contest in the state on Tuesday. Jesse Jackson Jr. is fighting to keep his seat in Congress in a primary battle, and Tea Party activists are taking on some top Republicans in Washington. Of course, we wanted to talk about all this, so we've called upon two veteran journalists. Laura Washington is a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, and Nia Malika Henderson is a national political reporter for the Washington Post. Welcome back to you both. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So, Nia Malika, before we turn to Illinois, we want to take a quick look back at the Puerto Rico primary. Mitt Romney trounced the field there. His rival Rick Santorum got some heat for saying he wouldn't support Puerto Rican statehood until English was the main language on the island. He also seemed to be a little confused about what the law requires there. But, Nia Malika, I wanted to ask, and I know a lot of people are bored with this question, but we have to ask at this point that does Rick Santorum have a path to the nomination? He's got fewer than half of Mitt Romney's delegates at this point.
You know, the short answer is no, and they seem to know that at this point. They put out a memo last Monday, which essentially says that their plan isn't so much to gather the 1,144 delegates needed to go into Tampa with a clean win, but really to deny Romney that opportunity. Now, Santorum has got a wingman in Newt Gingrich who seems like he's going to stay in this thing and scoop some delegates up along the way. He also has a very, very slim chance at winning this whole thing. But I think Santorum, by going to Puerto Rico, where a place where he had little chance of winning, he's essentially saying he's in this thing. He's not going to cede any ground at all to Romney. You see him pulling within the margin of error in Illinois in that race there, about 4 or 5 points difference in the recent polls. So we'll see what comes out of this week with the Illinois primary Tuesday and then on Saturday in Louisiana, where Santorum should do pretty good.
Okay, so Laura Washington, what are we seeing from the candidates in this final run-up to the vote? Who's making a good showing in Illinois? Worth noting that Ron Paul and Newt Gingrich didn't even campaign in Puerto Rico. So what's happening in Illinois?
Well, Gingrich and Paul did campaign briefly in Illinois last week, a couple of appearances here and there, but then they've moved on. But so the race is really Santorum and Romney. And Romney is spending, as usual, as he has done in every case, millions of dollars in ad buys to try to push back this challenge from Santorum. I think he's concerned. I think that he has been pointed out he is the front runner at this point, but he spent a lot of time in downstate Illinois this weekend. Downstate Illinois and central Illinois are traditionally much more conservative than the collar counties around Chicago. And Santorum has really made a real hardcore bid down there, particularly among evangelical voters and Catholic voters. Of course, he's a Catholic himself. Romney was concerned about that enough that he spent several stops over the weekend. So it's really neck and neck at this point. Santorum is at a slight disadvantage because he didn't file delegate slates in every single congressional district. So even if he were to pull out a win, he wouldn't get as many. He wouldn't get all of the 54 delegates that are in play.
The same thing that happened in Ohio. Wasn't able to capitalize even on the fact that he seemed to have some momentum there. So just briefly, Laura, what are you seeing there? Are you seeing sort of momentum one way or the other? Or is it kind of the same thing we've been seeing throughout, the two of them kind of grinding it out?
It's hard to tell. It would be an upset, certainly, if Santorum won, because this is a socially and economically moderate state, even among Republicans. But Santorum has surprised people before. There's so much more. What I'm saying is there's much more energy and excitement around Santorum's campaign. People who are supporting Romney are supporting him because they see him as being the best to beat Obama. They see him as being more the traditional choice. But Santorum definitely has momentum.
We're talking politics with Laura Washington of the Chicago Sun-Times and the Washington Post's Nia Malika Henderson. We're a day away from primary elections in Illinois. And now I want to wheel around and talk, Laura Washington, about an interesting race on the Democratic side of things. A change in district boundaries has led to Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. being challenged by former Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Halverson. And Jackson, of course, is the son of the famed civil rights leader Jesse Jackson. Size this up for us, Laura Washington. Is Debbie Halverson a contender? What's her argument about why she needs to replace Jesse Jackson? Very unusual for incumbents to have a strong challenge, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's because incumbents, especially entrenched incumbents like Jackson, are very difficult to beat. Halverson saw Jackson as being vulnerable coming out of the long investigation, federal investigation of Rob Blagojevich, and the allegations that he did some horse trading with Jesse Jackson Jr. for Barack Obama's open Senate seat. Jackson Jr. has denied this through and through. He has said repeatedly that he will be vindicated. He has testified in Blagojevich's trial that he had no involvement in trading and offering campaign funds for the seat. But that investigation, as I said, has been ongoing. It seems to be dormant now. There's also a House Ethics Committee investigation that's still underway. Halverson saw that as making Jackson vulnerable. She lost her seat 2 years ago. She had been a one-term congresswoman, so she saw this as an opportunity. You're right. There has been redistricting. The district looks – his second congressional district looks a little different. It's less African-American, but still majority African-American. There are more southern suburbs in the district, and – in fact, she is now in his district, so she saw this as an opportunity.
And we do have to just ask about, does race play a role in this race from what you can – ethnicity, let's say, from what you can see? As you mentioned, it's a black majority district. The Jackson family, regarded highly, as certainly has long roots as, you know, activists, and Debbie Halverson is white. Do you have any sense of whether race is playing any role in how people are evaluating these two candidates?
No, race really refreshingly has not come up in this contest, although Halverson does understand that she has to appeal across racial boundaries because she doesn't have enough white and perhaps more conservative voters in the district to beat out Jackson. But they've both gone out and wooed African-American ministers, African-American churches. The difference is that Jackson not only has the incumbency and the perception that he's a winner, he also has almost every Democratic Party leader in the state lined up behind him.
You know, it's also, Nia Malika Henderson, it's interesting because redistricting has also created an interesting dynamic in another race, that the one Republican congressman in the Chicago area will probably lose, or may lose, because Democrats in Illinois were in charge of redistricting, and they drew a new map that puts incumbents Adam Kinzinger and Don Mazzullo in the same district. And that's interesting because Kinzinger was a Tea Party favorite when he won his first term in 2010. Who did he unseat? Debbie Halverson, who we were talking about. But now some of the Tea Party people have turned against him. And so, Nia Malika, I was interested in saying he's not conservative enough. And
right.
So are Republicans nationally looking at this and kind of trying to figure out, you know, how to play this? Just as it's, I wonder if it's kind of mirroring the larger battle in the primary race for the White House over
that's
what
exactly
conservatism
right.
means here.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's a litmus test over conservatism, what it means. Is it fiscal conservative? Is it social conservatism? Is it a little of both? And you saw this play out in some ways in Ohio, too, with Representative Kucinich and Representative Kaptur, both the victims of this redistricting. And, of course, Representative Kucinich, a stalwart liberal, went down to defeat in that race. And here in Chicago, you have this same, or Illinois, you have this same dynamic playing out, a real test and contest of what it means to be conservative. On the one hand, you've got Kinzinger, who opposed some budget proposals and some cuts, and then you have in Manzullo, a 67-year-old. He's been in Congress for quite a while, and so Kinzinger is basically arguing, here is Manzullo, who's been in that district for something like 20 years, and he hasn't done much, is Kinzinger's argument. And Kinzinger really trying to play up his bona fide Tea Party credentials and saying that he is still fresh blood here in this race, and somebody can bring that spirit out to Washington.
You know, Laura Washington, it's interesting because Kinzinger has kind of made a splash. I mean, he's an Air Force, you know, veteran, a pilot. I mean, according to one report, when he first came to Congress, he's like the Tom Cruise of the Congress. And I wonder if any of that is helping him now, Laura Washington, or is it not?
I think it's helping him. He was perceived when he was elected 2 years ago as the darling of the Tea Party, but I think he's also seen by the traditional Republican wing of the party as a rising star because of his age, because he's got this war hero persona, and he's making the case that it's time for change in Washington. We need fresh blood. We need blood. The irony is that he's angered some of his Tea Party support because he has moved closer to the traditional party establishment. He has been working closely with John Boehner on some issues, and he's voted against some Tea Party interests is in Congress. So in some ways, he's sort of emerging out of the Tea Party mantle and trying to make a case for being a more broad-based, conservative but more broad-based political operator.
Okay, Laura, I'm putting you on the spot because you're a columnist. So how do you call that race?
That one is really close. That one is really, really close. Again, I think in this case, Kinzinger has the momentum.
He does. He does. All right. Well, something to watch. Laura Washington's a columnist with Chicago Sun-Times. She joined us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Nia Malika Henderson is a national political reporter with The Washington Post. She joined us from the studios here, their studios here in Washington, D.C. Nia Malika, Laura Washington, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, we are going to hear about this year's offerings at the Israel Film Festival, which is being held in Los Angeles. This seems to be something for just about every taste, from political dramas to romantic comedies to documentaries. We'll hear from the founder of the festival, which is in its 26th year, in just a few minutes. But first, more on a sad story that is all too real. Last Friday, a jury in New Jersey found 19-year-old Darun Ravi guilty of a hate crime. It's September of 2010, just a few weeks into his freshman year at Rutgers University. Ravi used his webcam to spy on Tyler Clementi, his college roommate, while Clementi was having an intimate encounter with another man in their dorm room. Ravi also tweeted about it. A few days later, Tyler Clementi committed suicide. The case quickly became part of a national conversation around bullying, particularly involving young gay people, as well as around the mores of social media. While Darun Ravi was not charged with Clementi's death, he was charged, along with invasion of privacy, with something called bias intimidation, and the jury agreed. Ravi now faces up to 10 years in prison. As we said, this is a complicated case on many levels. It's being much discussed for its potential to set precedent in laws around bullying. So we called upon Jessica Henry. She teaches and writes about hate crimes as an associate professor at Montclair State University's Department of Justice Studies. She followed this case closely. She's also a former public defender in New York. Professor Henry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, as we said, Darun Ravi was found guilty of invasion of privacy. I think everybody understands what that means. But he was also convicted of something called bias intimidation. And that's something that the jurors said that they struggle with. And there was an interview with juror Bruno Ferreira on CNN's Anderson Cooper the night the verdict was reached. I just want to play a short clip of that.
We pretty much had to figure out whether or not he did it on purpose. We had to really get inside his mind to see if he actually did it intentionally with purpose of bias towards his roommate.
Could you tell us more about that? What is bias intimidation?
Sure. In New Jersey, bias intimidation is New Jersey's version of its hate crime law, and it's a little bit unusual. First of all, it's unusual because invasion of privacy serves as one of the offenses that can actually ratchet a typical crime into a hate crime. That's unusual in and of itself. Not too many states include invasion of privacy there. But under the bias intimidation statute, Darun Ravi could have been convicted if he purposefully, knowingly, or caused Tyler Clemente to feel intimidated because of his sexual orientation. And the jury did a very interesting thing. There were two incidents in question. One was the actual filming on September 19th for a few seconds when Tyler Clemente had his friend MB to the dorm room. And the jury in that case found Darun Ravi was guilty of bias intimidation, not because he purposefully intimidated Tyler Clemente, but because, one, he knowingly did so, and two, because he caused Tyler Clemente to be intimidated and to reasonably believe that Tyler Clemente was targeted because of his sexual orientation.
What was the evidence of that, by the way? Or does the case even require that there was evidence that Daron Ravi would not have acted in the same way if Tyler Clementi, for example, had been with a woman and not a man?
No, we know from the tweets that Tyler Clementi's sexual orientation, the tweets issued by Ravi, had something to do with the filming. But no, it's not clear that had Tyler Clementi brought a woman that he met on the internet who was 30 years old into his dorm room, that Daron Ravi wouldn't have done the same thing.
And was there evidence that Ravi intended to intimidate Mr. Clementi, or is that even required?
Well, under the statute, again, this is a complicated statute. Even the judge said, once the jury was excused, that he found this statute to be quite muddled. He said it on the record. It's been reported. So even the judge struggled with this statute. What the jury decided ultimately is that there's two incidents. One happened on September 19th, and one was an attempt to record on September 21st. And that never actually occurred because Tyler Clementi turned off the computer. The jury decided that second time, that attempt, was purposeful and knowing and also caused Tyler Clementi to be intimidated.
What was the defense? And I do want to mention here that the facts are not in dispute, although I do think it's worth mentioning that some of the public narrative around this case is wrong, that, you know, Mr. Ravi did not out Tyler Clementi. You know what I mean? He was not private about his sexual orientation. Some of that. So some of the stuff that's been discussed is not accurate. But what was the defense here?
The defense, in essence, was that what Daron Ravi did, while it may have been reprehensible, we may all be really uncomfortable with the idea of turning on a webcam on a roommate's private moment, that it was not done with bias, it was not done to intimidate, and it was just a stupid act. And the jury rejected that.
My guest is Jessica Henry. She's an associate professor at Montclair State University's Department of Justice. We're talking about the verdict in that case involving the student who spied on his freshman roommate at Rutgers University. That student was convicted of bias, intimidation, and a number of other charges on Friday. We're talking about what precedents might be set here. So, Professor Henry, what about that? I mean, in a lot of these areas like bullying and social media and is still kind of uncharted territory. What precedents do you think are being set here? And do you think this case will affect other states as they consider these kinds of laws?
That's a terrific question. And so you can break that down on two levels. One of the things that I hope happens from this case is that we start a much more public narrative about bias based on sexual orientation, not one necessarily that revolves around criminal law, but one that revolves around education and conversations about how we treat bias-based bullying that's targeting people based on their sexual orientation. We have politicians who still feel very comfortable making comments that are not supportive about sexual orientation. We've got a public that is not, you know, Tyler Clementi, when he came out, he was obviously conflicted. And Ravi was not charged with Tyler Clementi's suicide, in part because Ravi's actions probably was not the only reason that Tyler Clementi committed suicide. There were, I'm sure, many different reasons that speak to how society views sexual orientation. This invites a conversation about that.
Do you think, though, that that was unspoken, though? I mean, I guess what I'm asking you is, do you feel that the terrible death of this young man did, in fact, influence the course of the case, even though he wasn't formally charged with the death?
I think it did, only because I don't think the police would have been involved. And if the police hadn't been involved because Tyler Clementi died, I don't know that Rutgers would have reported it to the police. It may have been dealt with internally. Tyler Clementi had requested a room change after the first incident, and that room change probably would have been granted. I can't speak to whether Daron Ravi would have otherwise been sanctioned at the university level, but I'm not sure we ever would have gotten into court in the first place. And
now,
I'd also—oh,
okay.
I'm sorry.
And I was going to say, Ravi, we only have about a minute left. But Mr. Ravi's lawyers say they are going to appeal the case. What are the grounds, do you think, for the appeal?
One of the grounds, I think, is going to be the statute itself and the constitutionality of the statute, which required the jury to get into the minds both of Daron Ravi and of Tyler Clementi. They also will probably question whether or not the prosecution established bias in the way that hate crime statutes were first envisioned to capture.
Like what?
Well, when you think about hate crime laws, you think about sort of the neo-Nazi extremist. And now what we have is a young college man who's facing a potential of 10 years incarceration for something that many people think was a foolish and reprehensible college prank or college decision.
In the meantime, sentencing is set for May, as I understand it, as a former public defender. What is your sense, and forgive me, I know I'm asking you to predict, but what do you think is the probability that he will actually serve jail time?
Well, under New Jersey law, because it is a second-degree felony, there's a presumption of jail time. I don't think he's going to get that maximum 10 years, but I do think he may serve some prison time. Although, interesting, even Clemente's family has said that they don't think the most severe sanctions are warranted here. And also, Darun Ravi is now facing the potential of deportation, and so the judge may sort of take that into account as well.
Jessica Henry is an associate professor in the Department of Justice Studies at Montclair State University. She's also a former public defender, and she writes about and teaches a course on hate crimes. She joined us from our NPR studios in New York. Professor Henry, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks. It was a pleasure to be here.
If you like your TV programs with complex characters, tightly written scripts, with one foot firmly planted in the real world, then you are probably a fan of Homeland.
Last night at 2300, two UH-60 Black Hawk gunships lit the target with over 8,000 rounds. During the sweep, one of the Deltas found something else.
I'm an American.
But what you might not know is that American TV show Homeland, which airs on Showtime, is based on a hit Israeli television series. That connection is being honored at the Israel Film Festival, which is currently underway in Los Angeles. The festival is in its 26th year, and more than 30 titles are showcased this year, with everything from feature-length films to documentaries and student shorts and all kinds of subjects, including, and we really need to hear more about this, a film about a Mexican salsa dancer disguised as a nun. Here to tell us more about all this is the founder and executive director of the Israel Film Festival, Meir Fenigstein. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, so much of the news out of Israel, especially, you know, now, pertains to political conflict. But we notice that the subject matter of the festival is quite diverse. Has it always been that way?
It changed with the years. Now it's a little bit different what it used to be. 10-20 years ago when I started the festival, we showed a lot of films about the conflict, about the Israeli army. We don't have those films anymore. Most of the films are personal films, and that's why, as you mentioned, we have films like Salsa Tel Aviv or My Australia that is 70% in Polish. And Salsa Tel Aviv is 70% in Spanish.
Well, we have to talk about Salsa Tel Aviv. It is about a, let me make sure I have this right, it's about a Mexican salsa dancer who disguises herself as a nun who goes to Israel to work so she can send money home. But what develops is a love story. And we'll play a short clip.
Welcome to Israel.
En español, por favor. Gracias. ¿Ustedes van a Tel Aviv?
Well, you get a flavor there. What did you like about this film?
First of all, it's a telenovela. It's, you know, it's not exactly a film, you know. And what's interesting about this is that director Jorge Valle decided to make a film. He's Argentinian. He made what they call Aliyah to Israel, came to Israel about 20 years ago. And this is his first feature film. And the actors, the star of the film is Angelica Valle. She's very, very famous in telenovela in Mexico. Her mother is playing too. Her name is Angelica Maria, and she is like the Miss, the sweetheart of Mexico. And this is a, you know, the connection, the cultural exchange between Spanish and Hebrew, or, you know, if you can say between the Latin community and the Israeli community. That's what intrigued me to show this film in the festival.
You also have documentaries, as I said, and they deal with some, I don't know, how can we just say this, some difficult subjects, both personal and political subjects. One in particular that caught my eye was 77 Steps. Will you tell me about that and tell me why you like this film?
I really wanted to mention another film that I was more intrigued in 77 Steps, if you don't mind, is The Dolphin Boy. Because The Dolphin Boy is a film about an Arab Israeli that was bitten by his friend or in his neighborhood, and he was so hard bitten that he was basically out of, you know, he was not a human being anymore. And his Israeli doctor decided to take him to a treatment that is unusual, to take him to Eilat, is the city south of Israel that has a dolphin area, And he was there for 3 years and was swimming with the dolphin and got in love with the dolphin. He couldn't say one word. And after 3 years, he came back and came back to his family. And this all because of the dolphin. And I think this is a very, very powerful film. And I really recommend people to see this film because it's really fascinating.
What do you like about it?
The relationship, how somebody can, get related to a fish, basically, to a dolphin, and through his love and the relationship with the dolphin, he gets cured. It's amazing. Mm.
We're talking about the Israel Film Festival. It's currently running in Los Angeles. With us is the founder and executive director of the festival, Meir Fenigstein. Tell me about how, again, we were talking at the beginning of our conversation about how the festival has sort of changed over the years. What are some of the things that you've tried to do with it over the years as you've developed it? And what gave you the idea to begin with?
First of all, my background is I used to be in a rock band. I used to be a drummer in a group called Kaveret, or Beehives. My nickname is Poogie, P-O-O-G-Y. And this group is known in Israel as the Beatles of Israel. And this group was established in the beginning of the 70s. From the music side, I decided to go to study in Berklee College of Music in Boston. And there where I came with the idea of the festival in 1983, that I want to change for music after I've been already performing before 400,000 people in Tel Aviv, to do something else, and I wanted to stay in the United States and decided to bring Israeli films to America because I thought it's very important to showcase Israeli culture in America.
Well, what do you think is important to showcase, though? I mean, a lot of Americans go back and forth. I mean, is it, you know, they go back and forth, people have family ties and so forth. Is it part of what you're hoping people will see is what, beyond the headlines or the vibrancy of the culture?
Absolutely.
As it continues?
Absolutely. That's really what it is. It's beyond the headlines. And I think that because, you know, through the internet, everybody wants to know a little bit more personal stuff about the other cultures now. It used to be that everybody, you know, when we didn't have the internet, we didn't want to know. Now you can just put something and be in Italy right now, in Venice, and see what you want to see in Venice or know, or speak Italian or, any language. But what I'm saying is that the festival gives an opportunity to the public, and it doesn't matter if they are Jewish, Israeli, or anybody, to view the Israeli society in the best way, in the real way. And that's, I think, it's very, very important, not just for Israel, for any country.
Before we let you go, I did want to ask why you felt it was important and why the festival is honoring the American television show Homeland, which, as we said, is based on a hit Israeli series. Why do you think that's important? Because some people would say, well, you're copying me.
It's not exactly copying. This showed kind of a connection between the Israeli television and the American television because they basically bought the rights for the miniseries Chatufim. It's an Israeli miniseries. And they showed it in, and they created Homeland from that. And this was very important for the festival to really emphasize this point, that there is a real connection between the Hollywood community and the Israeli film community.
Meir Fenigstein is the founder and executive director of the Israel Film Festival, which is now in its 26th year. And he was kind enough to join us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Mr. Fenigstein, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations to you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we go behind closed doors, as we often do on Mondays. That's where we talk about issues people usually keep private. HIV/AIDS is still that kind of topic for many people, perhaps especially, according to our next guests, for members of the Navajo Nation. Members of the nation live on the country's largest Indian reservation, located at the crossroads of several southwestern states. Health professionals there have been seeing a steady rise in new HIV cases among the Navajo over the last decade. The Gallup Indian Medical Center has reported that the number of new HIV patients has more than doubled in the last 10 years. That's while infection rates have stabilized across the rest of the U.S., according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called upon Melvin Harrison, founding executive director of the Navajo AIDS Network. We also have with us Dr. Jonathan Iriluh, an infectious disease consultant who works at the Gallup Indian Medical Center, and they're both with us from member station KANW in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Iriluh, could you start by telling us about the trends that you've been seeing? When did you start to become concerned that HIV was becoming an issue in the nation?
I've been working with the Navajo people since 1994. And in the 1990s, we used to see somewhere between 5 and 10 new cases a year. During the decade 2000 through approximately 2007, we would see anywhere between 15 and 20 new cases per year. Back in 2009, we saw a surge in the number of cases up to 40 new cases per year, and that rise has been sustained over the last 3 years. So this past year, we saw 39 new cases.
What do you think is behind that?
Part of it is we're testing more. Starting back in 2006, the Centers for Disease Control advised that every American be offered the right to know their HIV status between the ages of 13 and 64. So in response to that, the Indian Health Service and other healthcare providers in the area are doing more testing. But we also believe that there is actually more local transmission and there is a true increase in the number of cases. In the past, HIV was thought to be a disease acquired in the big city, and then people would come back home to spend their last days with their family. But starting around the year 2000, we started seeing people coming down with high fevers, headaches, sore throat, rashes, suggestive of acute HIV infection. And then the blood testing proved that, in fact, these were brand new cases being acquired locally. We know also that HIV is transmitted when people's inhibitions are lowered through substance abuse. And we found that among our new cases, up to a half of them have alcohol as one of their risk factors. And when we first started seeing cases, the risk factor men who have sex with men was by far the largest risk factor for acquisition of HIV on Navajo. But over the last few years, there's been an increase in the number of cases acquired through heterosexual transmission, so that, in fact, in 2011, the risk factors are almost exactly identical.
Well, let's just pause there for a second and bring Melvin Harrison into the conversation. Mr. Harrison, I understand that you're HIV negative, but you came to be involved in HIV activism because of your own history with substance abuse. Could you just tell us a little bit about that, if you don't mind?
Yes, I became involved in early 1988. It was after going to a substance abuse treatment for alcohol and drug treatment where I learned about HIV. And it really scared the heck out of me. I really didn't know what to do. After treatment, I come home and I walk into this meeting at Chinle Hospital about a group of people trying to put a nonprofit program together at Chinle Hospital. It was really amazing how that all happened. I think it was the second meeting that I took over the meeting and decided to do the work, because just from how I was feeling, I just felt like something needed to be done at that time. That's where I felt my connection to the people that we were serving, because, you know, I think today when you talk about HIV, I think most people are very, very afraid of confidentiality being broken. And once that happens, they feel the rejection. And that's what I felt during my years of abusing drugs and alcohol.
Can I just jump in, Mr. Harrison? Because one of the interesting things you were telling us is that when I was listening to Dr. Iriluh talk about the way the disease is transmitted and what they've noticed about the differences over the years, one of the things that struck me was, this is so 10 years ago, so 15 years ago in the general population, and it sounds like there's been a lag in the Navajo Nation in the way that the disease has been transmitted. But one of the other things that struck me is that you were telling us that there are some cultural reasons why perhaps people might not have been able to protect themselves, given how much knowledge there already is about HIV/AIDS. Like, there are some cultural reasons why it wasn't as discussed. Do you mind talking about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. In most small communities, it's really hard to talk about sex and, you know, homosexuality and so forth. But on the Navajo Nation and other small Native communities, it's very, very, very difficult to talk about those topics. And so when I began to do HIV prevention education back in 1988, I really got scolded from my elders. You don't talk about this, my son. He says, we don't think it's here and it'll never get here. He says, if you're talking about it, you're wishing it on the people. And I didn't know what to say. So, and I remember those days. I'd come home and talk to my wife, you know, like sometimes tears running down my face. I can't go back out there. I was hammered today by my elders, you know. So those are the challenges. And in our Navajo tradition, we have a clanship. Like if someone's even related to me, like I have a sister clan-wise that's sitting here. I can't talk about sex. I'm not supposed to talk about sex.
So, Dr. Irulu, how do you work around that? You have to educate people, and you have to tell people when, presumably, when you figure out that they've been infected, you've got to figure out how to talk about it. How have you figured out how to work around that?
I talk about how things have changed dramatically since the institution of antiretroviral therapy back in the year roughly 1995-1996, and how it's dramatically changed the death rate on Navajo. So we used to lose up to 30% of our patients per year. Now the death rate is way down to around 5%. And those who pass away are usually dying of things other than HIV/AIDS these days. And I often tell my patients that it's much easier for me as a physician to treat the HIV disease than it is for me to treat diabetes. So we try to talk in a positive light, not in a negative one.
I'm speaking with Dr. Jonathan Irulu of the Gallup Indian Medical Center and Melvin Harrison of the Navajo AIDS Network. We're talking about the increase in HIV/AIDS in the Navajo Nation. It's our Behind Closed Doors conversation. Mr. Harrison, could you just pick up the thread there for a minute? What are some of the things that you've noticed have been helpful in talking to people and in doing your work after that initial difficulty and people saying, you're wishing this on us?
We sort of turned it back towards the elder and say, okay, if this is something we can't talk about, how can we talk about it? We've actually received some help with some of our elders to help us go out and do education. And since then, we've had a number of people who are HIV positive themselves who've come out of the closet and began to talk about HIV over the last 20 years. But it's still challenging because across the nation, even if I went to my local high school in Chinle, Arizona, we would find that a high percentage, I would say from 60% of our students, will think it's a gay man's disease. But I think we've come so far long enough now that we can really just have to, you know, take the beating and continue to do our education. But there's just very little of those because I think more people are more sensitive of what we're trying to do now.
What keeps you going?
Well, that's a good question. You know, this has been a very challenging work. You know, there's been some good times, some bad times, but I can remember, oh my God, back in 1988, I wasn't quite sure how long I was going to do this job, you know, after recovery. Just to start out, I remember sitting up on Canyon de Chelly. If you ever go to Chinle, Arizona, there's a small, beautiful canyon. It's a miniature Grand Canyon, I call it. It's a beautiful canyon. I would sit up there and I'd ask the creator, you know, give me something to do. I mean, I need to do something. And here, within a few months of that, you know, I get this job around HIV. And so sometimes I say this is the work of the creator. But in talking about what sometimes in my challenging days, you know, early on, right after I began to do full-time work in 1988, I met this young man. And how I met this young man was by walking into our local grocery store. My wife, I, my son were walking to this grocery store after the sun had gone down, and the young man touched my arm, says, you're Melvin. I said, yeah. And he says, can I talk to you? And I said, sure. And I turned around and we walked outside, and he was parked in this other unlit area. When we got there, the first thing he said was, Melvin, can I get a hug? And I said, sure. He says, Melvin, I have HIV, I have AIDS. I kind of like suspected I was shaking too. This young man was hanging on for dear life and he just held on to me. And then he says, Melvin, I'm also gay. I didn't know what to do, but he let go and we talked. And I worked with him for the next 6 to 8 months. He hadn't told anyone in his family. And I would visit him and I would take him to his healthcare provider down in Phoenix. It was like a 5-hour drive, but I would take him down whenever I could. I would hang out with him. We would go to church and we'd do certain things. We fought, we laughed, we cried, and he chased me out of his house. But he became a very, real close friend. He taught me of what I was going to be doing for whatever long. And one day I visited him and I said, it was in the evening, and stopped by and says, how are you doing? And when I walked into the house, I saw that he had separated a lot of stuff and a lot of his belongings on the floor. And I said, what are you doing? He says, he took a hold of my hand and he says, Melvin, I'm going to check out. He says, I can't do this anymore. He says, Melvin, I'm keeping you away from your family. You got work to do and all this. I said, no, you're not going to do this. Let's get you well. We talked and we laughed. We got away from, you know, talking about all that. And we talked about some good times, bad times. And I was there for about 2 hours. And we got back to saying, well, he says, let's see what we can do tomorrow. I stood up to go and he took a hold of my hand. He says, Melvin, there's only one thing I need to tell you, whether I check out or not. He says, keep doing what you're doing. Your Navajo people need you. And I took both of my hand and I just held on to him. He says, I'll see you tomorrow. You know, I had tears running down my face. This was in 1988. This young man hadn't told his parents, his loved ones, and he wouldn't let me tell anybody. And he would tell them, like, he has cancer and other stuff. But I walked out that evening. I went home and thought about him that evening and prayed and got word the next day that he had checked out.
What do you mean he checked out?
He died.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's what people used to say when, like, and sometimes, like, in HIV, he says, you know, when they give up, they say, I'm going to check out, you know. And I think that's what keeps me going sometimes. But there's a lot of other things, too. You know, like in the early days, like in the late 80s and early 90s, some of these young men and women didn't have a chance, as it seemed like, because there was, you know, all they had was AZT and certain things. And, you know, and it was really challenging for them. So those are things that keep me going, thinking about those young men and women, especially this young one that I started to work with the same year that I started to do this work. And
I'm sorry.
It's a part of me now. But of my wife, and I have, you know, I'm married and have two children. I actually am a grandpa right now, so my grandchild's outside.
Oh, well, congratulations.
No, thank you.
We want to keep you from him or her.
So, yeah, her.
Dr. Irulu, what about you? What keeps you going in this work? It's very challenging work.
Oh, yeah. Some things very similar to Melvin's, my Christian spiritual practice, and then really loving and supportive wife and children outside the hospital. And then in the hospital itself, it's been a really wonderful experience working with Navajo people. They're very gracious, kind, thankful people, and every day this is very reaffirming. And I work with many patients who've been afflicted with HIV for many years, and when I see the bravery with which they face their illness, I'm overwhelmed, and I think that keeps me going inside the hospital.
Do you see the numbers moving in the right direction, or are we not there yet?
One very important concept is that if people know their diagnosis, they can be treated early in the course of the disease, and then you can prevent spread of the HIV virus by controlling the level of HIV virus in a person's blood. So we think that early diagnosis equals early treatment equals decreased transmission. So what we're working on right now is a media campaign to get people out there aware of their HIV status.
Before we let you go, Melvin Harrison, I understand that your group has come up with kind of an unusual event to raise awareness about HIV/AIDS. It's this coming week, and I understand that you are doing a local stand-up comedy show.
Yeah, we are. It's actually one of the huge Navajo or Native comedy stand-up comedy shows. It's called the Ernie and James Comedy Show, and it draws a lot of people. And this is a free event, so we knew that if we were able to put such a show up, we would get a big audience. And this would be a great opportunity to talk about some HIV, talk about AIDS, and then also to offer rapid HIV testing to those ones who would like to get tested. And it will be at the Chinle Junior High School on March 20th.
Are you going to do stand-up?
No, I don't think so.
You're not going to add that to your repertoire?
Maybe. Well, Dr. Irulu probably have a lot of funny stories about our clients and people and how they talk about HIV and what they think HIV is. We could probably do that.
Okay, well, I don't know. He'll have to check with the medical board about that. I don't know if he's going to, if he can be making fun of it. Melvin Harrison is the founding executive director of the Navajo AIDS Network. Dr. Jonathan Irilu is an infectious disease consultant for the Indian Health Service. He works at the Gallup Indian Medical Center near the Navajo Nation. And I thank you both so much for speaking with us. Good luck to you both in this important work.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Now we have an update to a story we brought you last month. On February 7th, we aired a segment on unsafe work practices in Chinese manufacturing plants. Some of those work practices have drawn widespread criticism. In our segment, we used audio of storyteller Mike Daisy, who was featured in a story in the public radio program This American Life. In the segment, Daisy described poor working conditions for employees of a major supplier to technology companies, including Apple. Last Friday, This American Life's host, Ira Glass, retracted the reporting, saying it contained numerous fabrications. We regret having aired a portion of that now withdrawn report. NPR continues to independently report on some of the work practices at Chinese factories. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.